It just kind of reinforces the need for the higher level systems view of engineering problems and how you got to actively fight to break through the barriers to where we can work as a team, because even if you think your component doesn't impact someone else, it most always does.
Pashi presents The Means of Production, a podcast about what it really takes to build, maintain, and scale the processes that produce the physical products that power our world. Every episode, we ask a manufacturing expert to walk us through the nuts and bolts of how they do their job. We explore how and why they got into manufacturing, dive deep into the hardest problems they've solved on production lines, and discuss their thoughts on what's broken in manufacturing today and how those things can be fixed. This podcast is hosted by me, Sidith Sanghvi, Pashi's US Manufacturing Operations Lead and former assembly engineer at Ford Motor Company. If you are a part of the manufacturing world and you're interested in being a guest on The Means of Production, get in touch with me at sidith@pashi.com, which is sidith@pashi.com. Hello and welcome to Season 1, Episode 11 of The Means of Production. And today we have with us Ted Bohl, Programming Management Analyst from Ford Motor Company. Welcome, Ted.
You're good to be here. Hope you're doing well.
I am, Ted. Thank you so much. And before we get started, Ted is going to read out a disclaimer for us.
All right. Yeah, so I work at Ford, but this is my own opinion and not the opinion of Ford. I'm not a spokesman for Ford Motor Company, official or otherwise.
Thank you, Ted. So, Ted, firstly, it's been a while since we caught up. How is everything? How is work? How is the family? How is life treating you in the era of COVID?
And everything's good. I'm one of the few people that are fortunate enough to be able to go into work during like a build, or we can still work from home, but I've been going in a lot, which I enjoy.
That's absolutely great. And glad to hear that everyone is safe. All right, so Ted, why don't we begin the podcast? So, Ted, in your experience, and you've had lots of roles over the years, and you've done and been to a lot of places. How did you get to this role that you have at Ford? Firstly, you can explain a little bit about your role, and then say how you wound up here, and why did you select manufacturing?
Yeah, so I was retiring from the Navy in 2015. So I think in like 2014, I went to a job fair, the Service Academy Career Conference, and met Mario, who I believe you know as well. And we kind of hit it off. So he's the one that, helped me or guided me to be in the manufacturing engineer where we worked together.
Yep. And I know Mario. He's a great guy. He hired me in. He hired Zach Westhoff in. So,
but we can't hold that against him.
Yeah, he's an awesome guy, and hopefully I'll have him on the podcast at some point. So why Ford, and like why this particular? What interested you with Ford, and especially how did you? Or did you have any experiences growing up where you were, familiar with machinery or?
Yeah, so my first car, the first car that I had was a 68 California Special Mustang. So I used to joke around that it was no longer a Ford, it was a Bull, because I legitimately don't think there was a nut screw or anything in it that I didn't have off and back on at one point, either restoring it or repairing it. So when I was at the career conference, I jokingly approached Mario and, told him I was mad because I had Fords my whole life. I had three in the driveway and I got a card from GM and not Ford. So he kind of laughed and we talked for, 20, 30 minutes. And he asked me what I wanted to do. I was like, well, you work there. I've never worked there. I don't know what I want to do. You've talked to me long enough to know the type of person I am. Where do you think I would fit in? So he made some suggestions and I applied and ended up getting hired by Ken.
That's so funny. That's a great way to That's fantastic. This is the first time I've heard like a approach to a recruiter in that method.
And I've hired alongside Mario at Virginia Tech, and candidates are super serious and like very earnest and stuff like that. So I guess they can take a leaf out of your book and just like try and use humor a little bit. Of course, there's a fine line there, but humor always works. Ease the tension between recruiter and candidate. So great going over there, Ted. So, well, after that, I know that you were working, in the same group I was. We were making the 10-speed rear wheel transmission that goes into some of Ford's marquee products like the F-150, Mustang, and Transit, and other vehicles. But I don't know anything about your previous roles, your time in the Navy, and especially with other roles in Ford that you had. Can you talk about a technical problem that really, really challenged you? And, you know, it doesn't matter if it was like one problem or just a set of bad days, but something that is etched in your memory that you always remember that technically really challenged you.
Yeah, so I mean, there's a bunch, so it's difficult picking one, but one that sticks in mind is when I was in the Navy, we had a gas turbine engine that was overheating, and I was the main propulsion assistant, which is basically like the assistant to the chief engineer on a ship. So we had a Allison K501 gas turbine generator that was hot starting, and we had to troubleshoot it kind of while at sea over, you know, using phones, calling back. So I had a chief and I kind of worked as a team calling back to, NAVC to find out why it was doing it. And, you know, after a long analysis of the problem, we determined that basically the mechanical people didn't talk to the electronic people. So they upgraded the cans or the combustion chamber with a ceramic lined, ceramic lined can, which made it more efficient. But since they didn't talk to the electric people, the EGTs that were coming off of that can misinterpreted the fuel input. So it was scheduling more fuel than needed because it naturally had burned cooler. So that was kind of something we worked through. And then funny enough, fast forward 8 years while I was a helicopter pilot, we had gas turbine engines that had just gotten upgraded cans and it was overheating. So I immediately said, well, obviously you guys didn't talk to your fuel schedulers because you're got too much fuel in. So I was on duty and I was at the desk and the phone rang and it was NAVAIR and they asked for me. And I said, well, that's actually me on the phone. So he said, we're trying to find out who you are and how you know so much. I was like, well, it's not that I'm smart. It's not that I'm good. It's just I've seen it before. The same thing happened with the Allison K501 engine when I was on the ship. So kind of a funny story, but it just kind of reinforces the need for the higher level systems view of engineering problems and how you got to actively fight to work around communications issues and break through the barriers to where we can work as a team. Because even if you think your component on the aircraft, on the car, on the, whatever it is, doesn't impact someone else, it most always does as a systems point of view. If that makes sense.
No, that is, well, I guess the most novel technical challenge for me, because my understanding of naval engineering is zero. So I'm going to break down your answer and I want you to assist me in helping me understand and just familiarizing the audience with some of the terms that you just mentioned. Is that okay?
Yeah.
All right. So what I see is that hot start is any variant of a jet engine where the manufacturer defined limiting temperature for start has been exceeded, right? So is that what happened? It overheated.
Correct.
During start.
Yeah. So okay. When a gas turbine engine starts up, there's, and it's been probably 10 years since I had to know this, so please forgive me if it's not completely technically accurate, but the fuel scheduling is a function of, the pressure, the temperature, and, NG or engine speed, so that you know at what RPM your engine is, turning. The pressure will tell you density, altitude, and then the engine speed, it lets the engine know how much it needs to start up. If you have too much or too little, it can either give you a compressor stall or where it's like too much. It's literally like an explosion that can damage the engine, or a hung start where it doesn't have enough fuel to continue its ramping up.
I see. So the engine speed, which is RPM, the density, which is that the air density surrounding the... Okay.
Yeah, like and how much mass of air you have in that charge.
I see. And obviously the altitude in case it is starting from air. This happens when you're restarting. When you say altitude, does that mean when it's restarting?
What density, altitude, or how dense that air charge is to determine the mass, which is kind of how much fuel you need to... that's probably an overly simplistic way to explain it, but at the end of the day, it's just how much fuel you need to keep the start going.
Well, this I'm finding it very fascinating, and I'm sure a lot of people not familiar with like jet engines and turbines are also. Now, you said EGTs, so this is exhausted gas temperature?
Yes. Well, it's just the temperature of the in the can to let you know. You know, you don't want to get it too hot, obviously, or it'll melt, you know. So if your temperatures are going up too rapidly or during the start, it'll automatically abort the start.
And what is...
As a machine protection.
And what is a ceramic-lined can? When you say can, is that the C-A-N, like can?
So there's like three... There's several different gas turbine engine designs. So the two in particular had... You know, I think it had like six cans that go around, kind of the 360 degrees. And then your fuel nozzles shoot in there. And then the air as it comes in hits it and catches on fire and expands. And you have to keep all your pressures going in the right direction so that it doesn't come back at you. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Can you smell cans? Is that the same as the C-A-N can?
Yeah, just like a soda can. It's probably an unofficial term, but...
Oh, okay. So it's basically that whole container with the turbine, the fuel.
Correct. And, like six soda cans in a circle.
Oh, wow. Now I get it.
All kind of fluid dynamically designed to prevent any of the gas from actually touching the edges.
Perfect. Now I fully understand.
An overly simplistic view, I think.
No, and that's what we need at a very high level in a podcast like this, right? Yeah. I'm sure we can have a... You can go on for like several hours, like talking.
Well, I'm no expert, so it's just kind of the way, I remember it. But when you're a pilot, you kind of have to know how everything works, so that when you're flying, you know if you have to land right away or if you've got time.
Of course. That was a very fascinating technical problem, and I'm glad I and the audience got to hear about an incident during your time in the service. So. Thank you for the answer, and also thank you for your service to the country. So moving on, Ted, you've worked with a lot of people in the Navy, in Ford, other places. What was a non-technical problem that you had to deal with that you can talk about?
Non-technical is just kind of, probably the lowest hanging fruit of them all, is just dealing with different personalities and people of like diverse backgrounds, people that have different opinions, experiences, and all of that. So you kind of have to embrace, the diversity and the different opinions of everybody to kind of leverage the team to, meet the end state, mission or goal, right? In the Navy, I had anywhere from 36 guys down to like five with different education levels that you had to motivate to, kind of join and do work. Or when I'm at Ford and as a program management analyst, my boss will give me different projects to work on, and you have to gauge every member of the team's, expertise, so you know where to help, where to leverage them. And then you also need to kind of maintain a broad base talent, a broad-based area of expertise within the company, so you knew who to reach out to for help. I don't know if that answered the question, but...
No, yeah. And I believe that, those two experiences would have a lot of things in common, but a lot of things different. And did you feel like, there was a shift in how you had to how you had to think and how you had to operate between the Navy and working for a, like a company, commercial company like Ford?
There's a lot of differences, but a lot of similarities too. So you just kind of have to gauge where you're at and what you need and roll with it, you know? So one big, I grew up in California, so you'd not have much experience working with a union at all. And one of the things I really kind of enjoyed most about when we worked together would go down to the floor and work with all of the, you know, the UAW members. Just, I mean, you remember Roxanne and...
Yeah, absolutely.
And, you know, Steve and, you know, everybody down there. And you just build these deep personal bonds and friendships with them. And it's kind of interesting because, you know, if you tell them what to do, they're not going to do it. If you kind of convince them that it needs to get done and work with them and ask them and you're respectful and appreciative of what they do, they literally will move like heaven and earth to get it done. I just can't overstate how much I enjoyed working, you know, in Livonia and at New Models. And you know, granted, those are my only two data points. So I'm sure that some plants have higher challenges than others, but you know, I just really enjoyed or currently enjoy working with everybody.
Ted, I couldn't have said it better myself, that if you just show your face every day in the plant, 95% of the problems with working with anybody in the plant are gone. If they know you're sincere and they know you're working for the progress of the company, like you said, they will move things that otherwise might take like managers and you know general engineering protocols to take weeks. They might just say, you know, oh, we got it done over the night. You know, they'll just do it for you. And a lot of people don't know that, and I'm glad you brought it up. So
yeah, and more importantly, you're not going to get that the first day you walk down. You got to earn your keep, so to speak. They can trust you. They know you're not going to A lot of times, you know, when you're walking by, if you only go to them with a problem every time, then they're going to know you're just the guy that wants something. But if you take the extra 2 or 3 minutes when you're walking by to say hi and just being friendly, you know, that's just life. You know what I mean? In general.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well said, Ted. Yeah. So I think that was a good statement about, you know, I guess that was a great answer on how to avoid non-technical problems, especially on the floor. So thank you for that. I'm very interested. Do you have other like things that you observed in the while you were working in the Navy? Because that example was very fascinating. If you have more, I'd be very happy to hear.
I wanted to try to adapt the aviation style, you know, aviation type of training to the manufacturing environment. So what I mean by that is when you go through flight school, and I guarantee anyone listening can learn how to fly. It's not hard. It's well defined. And there's a very defined syllabus. So you do A, you perfect A, you move to B, you move to C, and some people, you know, typically your jet pilots will have one time through and they'll be fine. Other people might take 2-3 times to go through. So the, you know, Navy, like everybody else, has a defined budget, so they can't afford to have you go through 10 events each time. But so not everyone makes it, but I think everyone could make it given enough time and energy. So what I would think would be cool in, a plant is to take that same mentality of training that the Navy uses. And you could look at downtime against FIS, which is our, I forget what it stands for, but the data on, you know, how fast.
Right. Factory information system that provides JPH. Yeah.
Yeah. So you could look at a downtime event to where sensor XYZ faulted out on station 10. And it took the team 15 minutes or an hour to recover, and you could use that FIS data to measure that, and then you could send a controls engineer into the same station at a downtime event, for instance, where you were starving for stock or there was downtime, and you could send your trades in to do the exact same fault, and you could have on-the-job training to help the team review what had happened the day before and go through their emergency procedures or their recovery. And then you could wait until the event happened again and measure it. So you know that your first time it took 30 minutes to recover and your second time took 15. Hopefully it wouldn't take 45, but that would be a significant, you know, a worthy data point as well. So I always thought that that would be a cool thing to do to employ the trades and during, you know, make lemonade from lemons. So when you did get starved, instead of just sending the line on break, you could do training with the targeted team, and then you would have a measurable way to gauge the effectiveness of your training.
That sounds very interesting, because what essentially you're talking about is very similar to, from my experience, would also be in a pit stop, you know, in a Formula One team, where you are perfecting this response to an event. And every time you go, you want to get better. And this is essentially the kind of discipline and orchestration that would be required in the armed forces because of obvious reasons. And bringing that into a commercial organization like an auto company would bring in the same discipline, so that you have a set number of steps that you perform every time a machine goes down. And you can obviously, you know, adapt it to different kind of machines and different downtime events. But yeah, if there was a thumb rule that, you know, such and so and so fault would, you know, usually take like 20 minutes to reset, then, you know, why over time it should not take like 70 minutes to restart. And we all know that the mean time to repair is a very, very crucial metric for any production company that wants to not bleed money with downtime. So that makes a lot of sense, Ted. Thank you for that idea. And I hope, you know, someone listening to this might, you know, who's also come from that kind of a background would do something like this with all the training that they have got in the armed forces, and teach us about that kind of response time and that kind of response methodology.
No, I enjoy that kind of problem solving and stuff. You know, like we had on the build we just got through, we had our safety frames had some holes cut in the, some holes got cut in the frame, in the prototype frames, where they shouldn't have. So I kind of led an effort with, you remember, Zach, and then, you know, reached out to Zach and some other people that we knew, and kind of built a team of experts to define a measurable repair process to repair the frames. And then we set up we had the material labs do some testing to make to quantify our results, and reached out to some data people to help us interpret the data. And then I set up some kind of guidelines to train the welder on gave him samples and practice, and then when he was proficient, we went ahead and authorized the repair. And then the vehicles went through their required safety training, and we were able to analyze the data to measure our success. And we found out that, through all of the, the work paid off, because the data showed that it was, homogeneous to the original metal. If that makes sense.
Yeah. No, that's a good example.
But like that team building at front is like, you kind of do that brain, we'd call it like a mission analysis in the military or whatever it was called, but it's just kind of like a brainstorming. You remember in like fifth or sixth grade, your teacher sat and just had the class kind of brainstorm. And it's like, all right, team, who else do we need? Okay, let me reach out. You know, if you get too many cooks in the kitchen, you spoil the soup, right? So it's got a fine line, but you get five or six people, you build your team, you gain everybody's confidence. If anyone has any concerns or, brings up points, you honor them, and you try to do your due diligence to resolve those concerns and appreciate their background for bringing up those concerns. And, you identify your risk and then you control it. So it was a lot more work than it probably sounds like, but just convincing everybody that this is the right way to do it, that we don't need to absorb a 2-month delay in the program to get new frames. We can repair these to the same, you know, quality before, because when it comes to something like that, you can't jeopardize any quality or safety.
And I guess the next question is, if you had a magic wand to change one thing about your work or about like the industry or just manufacturing in general, what would that be and why? But it can't be like, within reason. So within reason.
Well, the wand's magic, so it doesn't have to be too reasonable.
Sure. Okay. Go ahead.
That's okay. No, I mean, this might be too out of the box, but I mean, I can always answer it again if you want. But honestly, like, we all talk about diversity. And if I had a magic wand, I'd want to wave it and get people to thoroughly like embrace that. Not just like diversity in origin or religion, but like diversity in thought. So we're all human beings and we all are a basis of our backgrounds unique. Rural, you have some people that grew up in a city. You have some people that grew up overseas. You have some people that grew up around here. So it's that diversity and like unique thought where you really need to leverage to come up with the best solution overall. And in any big corporation or any big entity, whether it's the Navy or Ford Motor Company, people are very hesitant to entertain something that is outside of their comfort zone. And I think diversity means you're supposed to embrace, you know, the man or woman that came from a different part of the world with a different unique background's opinion. And, you know, I think if we all could do that to challenge ourselves to entertain the diversity, not only of, you know, the stereotypical diversity of religion and upbringing and race, but just the diversity of ideas, I think that we would all be better off. So that when somebody says something that you might not necessarily agree with or that might somewhat make you uncomfortable, try to put yourself in their shoes and see why they feel that way and then talk it out. You know, if it's something you don't agree with, well, why do you think we should do XYZ?
Yeah, that's a very interesting notion that you just mentioned, which is, I'll repeat it because it's worth repeating, which is diversity in terms of difference in ideas and diversity in ideas rather than just the regular diversity. And that makes a lot of sense because coming back to the commercial aspect of a business, you want all ideas to be different so that you have a lot of like a wide pool of rich ideas to select from, and the best ideas will eventually help the company move forward. So yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And like you said, we need a magic wand because it's easier said than done, but that's not a way that I have you know thought about it before, because you can, you know, it may not be possible to dissociate the two, but certainly we can attempt to you know, think more like that, diversity of ideas rather than anything else. While the regular diversity is also very important, I think the focus that you were mentioning is very important. So yeah, I get that, and that's a good magic wand answer, Ted. And to wrap up like our conversation, I want to ask you that if this was 2051, or if you know you transported in time to 2051, what would the factory of that time look like, or how would manufacturing look like in 2051?
Well, I will say that anyone that thinks robots are going to take over the world probably hasn't sat at a robot and looked at it for 2 hours during the night shift, wondering why it's not moving, only to have day shift come in and, you know, enable some switch or something and everything goes moving. So I do think that obviously we're going to have a higher level of automation. We're going to have more robots, but at the end of the day, it's not a one-for-one removal. You're going to still need people to manage those robots. You're still going to need people to provide preventative maintenance to the bearings, provide preventative maintenance to the software and resetting it, do optimization of the flows, analyze the path of the robot to see if you can maybe cut a corner. So there'll still be people 2051 It will just need to be a more educated and more technically savvy workforce.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And the folks, and you know, we've had this conversation with like other guests in which, you know, more automation is like the obvious answer, but also that the same people who are training robots now would in the future become consultants or people who maintain like 100 robots, because you still need that few people who are super knowledgeable about how to maintain it to still come into the plant and you know, at least revive them if once in a long while, if durability and dependability is very high in the future, to still come in and at least manage them, like you said. So absolutely.
But I don't, you know, and then there's some, like, I mean, we still have horses. So there are still,
there's
still tasks that are best accompanied by a horse. So getting lumber out of the woods, you know, if you want to get, if you want to harvest a very unique wood species from a forest or something, getting a tractor in there is just extremely destructive. Whereas if you take in a mule or horse, you can pull that same thing out. So kind of the analogy for manufacturing is if you're seeding a bearing or if you're, you know, on the CDF, remember when we had all the issues seeding the clutch, you've got a technician that is a skilled union technician that is line side, and they know how to feel those clutches and engagement sequence better than any machine can ever do. So you can't just rule people out. Or a process that requires people to think or move or feel, there's always going to be those spots for humans, I think.
No, absolutely. And I was going to say another example is the wire harnesses that many people have tried to automate, but they have not been possible to be automated at the right cost. And a CDF clutch is another example. And for our audience, the CDF clutch is, you know, the nomenclature of the clutches that Ford gives, like the C, D, and F clutches, in which they are all assembled together in a way that a lot of splines have to be felt, finessed, and then, you know, aligned such that they become one whole. And that is kind of like a very standard process that all auto companies might be having for automatic transmissions. And what Ted is referring to is that finessing would require so many super advanced sensors and robotic movement that it would just not be feasible by anybody other than a human. And even only a few humans who are really adept at it by doing it over many months. So
yeah, and then the just natural, you know, variations of incoming stock means it's just naturally something that tends itself to where, you know, you couldn't program it to come in because the tolerances coming in on your individual clutches or your individual finishes are going to vary so much that it's just easier, better, and faster to have an individual do it. But that same individual is married together with lasers and vision systems that ensure quality. And you could have a force feedback to say that you didn't, you know, an operator didn't exceed whatever value that might, you know, do long-term damage to the components.
Absolutely. Absolutely. The variability is so high with that many parts in just a transmission, you know, forget the vehicle, that, yeah, training like artificial beings to that would be like a tall task. But who knows about the future? But thank you for that answer, Ted. So thanks, Ted. Those were great answers. I think there were some great ideas, very fascinating examples from your time in the Navy and a very different scenario or environment in Ford Motor Company where you adapted yourself and also led, you know, a lot of good projects, like the recent, you know, like the frame example that you gave for the prototype. And I really hear you on the magic wand answer and also the factory of the future answer with the human versus, you know, automation percentage or you know, involvement in the plants being a very realistic and likely answer of how a factory would look like in 2051. So I had a great conversation with you, Ted, and I'm glad we got to catch up through this podcast. And take care, say hi to the family, and have a good day.
Awesome, thanks. It was good catching up. I miss working with you and Shiv and Bill, and we got to get and Paul and everybody else. We need to get everyone together, meet up for lunch or something.
Yeah,
once we get out of the craziness of the current time.
Yeah, in the same Thai place that you like.
Yep. Best Thai food in Dearborn or whatever.
Yeah.
All right, cool.
All right.
Yep. Thanks again.
All right.
All right. Yeah, bye.
Bye-bye.
If you enjoyed this conversation, please subscribe to the Means of Production podcast for more stories from people behind all the manufactured goods we use, love, and depend on. This episode was made possible by Pashi, the operating system for manufacturing. Pashi unifies the entire production process for any product, encompassing operator instruction and data input interfaces, stage logic and parameter thresholding, machine interfacing and configuration, robot programming and coordination, and stage-to-stage production flow control into a single Pashi program. Check us out at Pashi.com. And until we meet again, have a fantastic day and take care.